First, Professor Melville, Charles Melville. He read Arabic and Persian at Pembroke College. Then he read for an MA in London. He worked as a research assistant in Imperial College in London. And then he began to study earthquakes. And it was earthquakes in Persia and the surrounding region that became the subject of his PhD dissertation. He then also moved on to study history and to study literature. He has written at least 7 books. He is on many editorial boards and learned societies. And he is now working, as I understand it, and you can correct me, on a huge project that involves one of the epic poems of Persia, which combines long before photonovellas, long before illustrated comic books, involved the use of great art and great literature at the same time. An epic poem, historical chronicle called The Shah Nameh. So I very much look forward to listening to Professor Charles Melville and thank him for being here. So let us move into the realm of earthquakes, history, literature, art, and epic tales.
Well, first of all, very briefly, because in fact it's true what Kate said about I have flashing cards almost coming up already, you know, that I'm behind schedule with my talk. But I just wanted to thank the organizers and our hosts for this, because it's been a superb operation of military precision. My day has been planned for the 10 minutes, really, since I arrived. And I should also thank, before I start, other people who've been involved in this project I'm going to talk about, because it's been going on for 10 years or more, and of course it's not all my own work. That includes my wife, who's sitting in the audience. I should also mention Farhad Mehran, who had the key idea, I think, that really transformed this from a research project into this internet-based program, and also the Center for Applied Research in Education Technology, which is called CARET, in Cambridge, which has really been the absolutely vital element of technical support and designing the website and the database and this sort of thing, without which, of course, ideas can't really get transformed into results. So the first thing to say then after that is that it's quite appropriate that we have a Persianist on this program this year, because today is Nowruz, the New Year's Day in the Persian cosmology, and recently recognized, as we know at last, by the UN as being a real holiday day. Secondly, because the Shahnameh, the book I'm going to talk about, was completed 1,000 years ago this month on the 8th of March, 1010. So this is the millennium year of the completion of the Shahnameh, and that's one of the remarkable things about it, of course, that this poem written 1,000 years ago is still very much studied and admired and is essentially in the home of every Iranian, I would say, in Iran and outside. And finally, to draw attention not only to the project, but also to an exhibition that we're holding in the Fitzwilliam Museum at the end of this year in September, which is a sort of culmination point, in a sense, of the early phase of this work. It brings it to some sort of a conclusion to have an exhibition of manuscripts and paintings from the Shahnameh in the Fitzwilliam Museum that's starting in September. So I do hope any of you who are over in the UK at that point will be able to come. Now, just very briefly, I'm just going to talk a little bit about what the Shahnameh is, and then about how it's been illustrated, and then I'm going to switch to why the internet or the database we've designed is useful for studying it and the sort of questions that it arouses and how it helps essentially analyze and penetrate more deeply into this remarkable work. So the first thing, I don't know if the pictures, if the light is okay. Very briefly, you see there it was composed over a long period. It's a lifetime's work of the poet Ferdowsi from the city of Tus in northeastern Iran. And it's very long. You see, it's over 50,000 verses. That's longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey put together. And it tells the story, essentially, of Iran's history, the myths of Iran, ancient Iran from the dawn of time. The earliest, it's the sort of Iranian view of the creation and the beginning of the Iranian people's myths and knowledge about themselves. And it's also a bridge between the Persian Empire, the great heroic days of the past, and the Iran of the Middle Ages, when Ferdowsi himself was writing, after the Arab invasions, after the Arab conquests, and the transformation of Iran into a province of the Islamic Empire, and a change of alphabet, change of religion, all this massive upheaval. And so the Shahnameh really bridges these two worlds. It makes, it preserves the memory of what was there before. And there are some key moments in this. Jamshid is an important figure. He's the first to bring society to organize society, teach the crafts, get every member of society in their proper rank. And this is very important for the old Persian view of society and the ruler's responsibility to keep everybody in their place, which of course modern governments also aspire to. And this is our boy Jamshid. He's carried by the Deevs, because part of the role of the ruler and the first men was to conquer the Deevs, who were the inhabitants of the earth beforehand, that's to say, sort of magical creatures and spirits who possessed great knowledge. They weren't just simply sort of wild beasts that had to be killed and destroyed, but they possessed ancient knowledge, and this knowledge was what was being appropriated by the humans, including, for instance, the art of writing. This is one obvious thing which was thought of as a devilish attainment, and this was traded in by the Deevs for some other benefit. Anyway, shortly after this scene, when Jamshid is carried by the Deevs, he's already conquered heaven and earth, as it were, and he initiates the day of Nowruz, which we are today or tomorrow, the festival of the new year and the new beginning. Later on, we have a very significant political murder. Iraj, one of three brothers, who was ganged up on by his other two brothers. He didn't want to rule. He was given Iran as part of his heritage. This was the choice part of the world. And his two brothers, who got the East and the West, were jealous. And he said, okay, you know, I don't want to rule. You have it. Leave me in peace. But they didn't. In fact, his attitude even enraged them even further. And here we have a very significant part of the Iranian spirit, which I think has survived into their approach to Islam, the idea of martyrdom, of sort of injured innocence. Because Iraj was politically naive, of course, but he was also completely innocent. And this not only sets a sort of pattern for this sort of, attitude, but also it defined Iran's place in the world, because after that it was just the world, and then after the murder of Iraj, we had Iran as a rival, a bitter rival even, to East and West. So it sort of determines Iran's place in the world. And the echoes of this murder spill over into a later story where another innocent prince called Siavush is murdered. I don't know if you can see that. Oh, yes, not too bad, actually. I've tried to use as many examples for this talk from as I can of paintings that are in collections in the US. He was also an innocent. And this has a great echo with the whole question of the martyrdom of Hussein and the martyrdom of the imams in Shiite Islam, which is, of course, the current religion in Iran. So there's a long pedigree for this sense of partly political naivety and partly injured innocence. Another key moment, among many, of course, is the conquest of Iran by Alexander the Great. And he was nevertheless absorbed into the pantheon of Iranian rulers. And here we have a touching scene with Alexander nursing the murdered Darius III in his lap. And of course, Darius says, you know, look after me, look after my family, marry whoever it was, Roxana. Don't do anything I wouldn't have done. And so this totally spurious sort of handover of legitimacy to the conqueror, who in fact destroyed great swathes of Iran and burnt Persepolis and ravaged the tomb of Cyrus. So nevertheless, he gets absorbed into the national epic. And then finally, I've just picked another important element in the epic, which is not only telling this story, but is also promoting certain values and ideals, really, of rulership. And we have the famous Sasanian emperor, Anushirvan, who was called Anushirvan the Just. And one of Ferdowsi's main political and ethical messages is that rule has to be accompanied by wisdom and by justice. And this message is brought home right through this enormous poem, but particularly in the Sasanian period, and it's particularly associated with the rule of Anushirvan. So there's many episodes where there's no real action, they're discussions, wisdom, literature, really, ideas, the ruler asking questions and having answers about how to rule and how not to oppress his subjects. And then finally, of course, the dying scenes, really, of the epic are the conquest of the Sasanians by the Muslim Arabs. And here we see the general, who's called Rustam, the same name as it happens, as the famous hero of the Shahnameh, wearing Rustam's clothes, which actually, because the artist can't bear to show the Iranian general being killed, we actually see Rustam killing the Arab general, as far as one can tell, although, of course, the whole thing is the most frightful muddle. This is just an example. This is from a mid-17th century manuscript in Corpus Christi, and a very interesting one, incidentally. So that, very briefly, is what the Shahnameh is about. It contains, as I say, not only some sort of vague political history, you could say, of the ancient kings of Iran, but also the spirit that inspired or should have inspired their rule. And of course, this is not just ancient history. As I said at the beginning, this is something that is still with us today. And here we have a poster, not really in focus, I'm afraid, of a conference to commemorate Ferdowsi's National Day a few years ago. So that's the Shahnameh itself. It's perhaps not surprising in view of what I've said that it's a book that's very much treasured, and so we see the arts of the book developing really in Persian culture, really concentrating on the Shahnameh as their main text. So we see beautiful bindings, we see beautifully illuminated pages, copies with these fabulous detailed work, all really to show the honor and the esteem in which the book is held. And we also see the development of Persian miniature painting very intimately tied up with the text of the Shahnameh. So there's very little illustration in Islamic manuscripts generally before the 14th century. They're mainly technical manuals of horsemanship or astrology or scientific manuscripts, of course, are illustrated. But from about the 14th century onwards, we begin to see poetry being illustrated, and the first text that is illustrated is the Shahnameh. I'm going to show you a set of pictures quite quickly, which gives you an idea of how the style evolved over 500 years, really, from 1300 to well into the 19th century. And I've tried to pick pictures that are illustrating the same scene, and mainly from American collections, but it hasn't been possible to do all of them. This isn't from the scene I'm going to talk about, which is the confrontation between Isfandiar and Rustam. Anyway, so the earliest ones look like this. They're just sort of narrow bands of painting across the page. There's a theory that perhaps this derives from wall painting. They're not really integrated into the manuscript in a very complex way. They're just put in the text at the appropriate moment, as I'll come on to, and they're very narrow, and they're just quite simple range of colors. Towards the end of the Mongol period, we get an extraordinary influx of ideas brought by the Mongol conquests from China and from Europe as well. Many new iconographic styles, modes of depicting events. This is far more sophisticated. Of course, it's taking up more room on the page. By the 14th century, we can see the picture really dominating the text, which is the reverse of what we saw at the beginning, where the text is really the dominant thing and just these narrow paintings. There are other interesting things I could say about this, but I will very briefly, because it's part of the point of the project. You see these pictures both depict a battle, and the text surrounds it. You see the headings are of different size, and the significance of this is that the artist have tried to fit the pictures onto the page with the text, even though the text, in fact, is of different lengths describing these battles. And so we're seeing, I'm going to come on to this a bit more later, I've mentioned it while this particular example is here, of manipulating the text of the Shahnameh to sort of frame the painting. So here we see that this box, which has the heading, takes up more space, for instance, than that box. So they're losing lines. They're losing one whole line. About six verses have gone. And in fact, if you analyze the text, you see that other lines have dropped out, because the idea is to have the nice design. So the poem, in fact, has become secondary to the painting. The poem lines can be thrown out or put in to make up the design. Then we have a beautiful manuscript in the Bodleian Library. I'm afraid I couldn't help. We all know where the Bodleian Library is. I should have left out that ghastly word towards the bottom. And this is a quite exceptional manuscript produced by one of the grandsons of Timur, one of three brothers. They all produced a manuscript. This is one of my favorite paintings. And Fruza, my wife, and myself, we've written a book about this manuscript, actually, which I hope that some copies are out there if you're interested to see. And we see all the time a fantastic refinement and greater range of colors. Here we see the artist spilling his work out of the margins, really taking over. An absolutely beautiful, meticulous painting. Very interesting rocks. These have got heads in them. They're called anthropomorphic rocks. And anyway, of course, one could go on for hours about all these things. But by the end of the 15th century, we have further developments. These lovely little heads look a little bit like space invaders. So they're sort of necklace wonders looking on at all the action. Most of these pictures are of the epic confrontation between Rustam and Isfandiar. And the famous Shah Tahmasp Shahnameh, which is in the Metropolitan Museum. Another royal one produced for Ismail II, and again in the Isfahan school. So we see a very different style of painting develop, all surrounding this one text. In fact, you could measure and monitor the whole development of Persian miniature painting just by studying manuscripts of the Shahnameh. If there were no other texts that survived at all, we would have a complete repertoire of the development of Persian miniature painting, right through to the Qajar period, which is normally decried, but there are some quite interesting and attractive manuscripts from the Qajar period, obviously showing much more European influence. So I hope that gets us quickly but inevitably on to the project. And these figures are all completely out of date because they're changing the whole time, but they were accurate about 2 or 3 months ago. You'll see that we have a database with, I've tried to assemble, or we've tried as our team to assemble as many, ideally all, illustrated Shahnameh manuscripts. And we've got about 18,000, it's actually nearer 19 or 20,000 illustrations actually recorded now. And a great number of these are on the website. Now, what's the point of the project? Because it's not simply just collecting these things and looking at them and saying how nice they are. There are many ways of approaching the text and the relationship between the text and the images, which I think are quite interesting. Because the first point is that we know almost invariably the text is written first and a space is left for the painting. So here's one example of many. Now, there are quite a few interesting things about this. One is you can see this crisscross script. And this can be a purely decorative element, but it can also be a way of, again, manipulating the text or using up space, because the artist normally wants to get to the verse that we have called the break line. And that is the last verse before the painting. In other words, this appears statistically to be like a trigger. So when the calligrapher gets to this point in the text, he knows he's got to leave a space for the painting. Now, it's no use if he gets to the verse before the painting there, because he can't fit the painting in that bit. And he'd either have to put in some extra lines or he'd have to lose some space. Anyway, you can see the point that the position of the text on the page is a significant element. It's not just random. It's not just writing out the script and then whacking in the picture. So this is a very good example of that. And one of the things we're doing with the website is to, perhaps I should go back just quickly, we get a coordinate of where the painting comes in the text, because of course the text has been edited, we have line numbers, there are several editions in fact. So we take the first line on the page, the last line on the page, and the line before and after the picture. So you've got it absolutely anchored in the text. And there are various applications for this. One of them is, of course, if you have a manuscript where pages are missing or have been deliberately broken up, but you have the basic framework, you can calculate. I mean, it's a simple mathematical thing. You can see how many pages, how many lines are missing. As it, say there was a gap here in this manuscript, say 20 folios have been taken out. You can see the last line before the gap and the first line after the gap. You can calculate how many lines are there, roughly. You know how many lines there are on the page, so you can say how many pages should be there. And say the number is not the same as the number of pages should be, you can tell that must have been a painting in there, or maybe two paintings, you see, because you know how much room it's taking up. So that would be one application. But anyway, the idea is we started with a database, and we're just recording the lines in these different editions. For some reason, we didn't get down to doing the lines for that edition here. This database was just an Access database designed by one of our Pembroke computer undergraduates. I'm happy to say Ian Murray, who did a fantastic job and got us to think systematically about what we were doing. So when you get an interesting painting like this from the store, again, I'm afraid this is this same manuscript with that awful place, we have a really remarkable relationship between the image and the text here, because this shows Bijan down the well. He's been thrown there. It's a sort of Romeo and Juliet story. Bijan is a Persian prince. He's fallen in love with a Turkish princess. Well, she's fallen in love with him, to be strictly honest. They get discovered. He gets thrown down a pit. And so the text here is really like a sort of surrogate bit of earth separating the top of the pit here from the bottom of a pit where Bijan is. And here we have the hero Rustam. There we have Manije, his girlfriend, and he has come to let him out. This is a most extraordinary depiction of the scene, but it is rather difficult to say exactly where the break line is, if you like, which of these lines is interrupting the painting. And in fact, it's quite obvious that the painting is taken over completely. But nevertheless, it's interesting to see by collecting this and many other examples to get a statistical sense that indeed the painting does normally come at a very precise point in the text. Now, of course, sometimes it's possible to identify the subject of the painting even if there are no words, because the iconography is so fixed and it's clear that this is the famous story of Prince Siavush going through an ordeal by fire. But there are other occasions where from the paintings, you can't tell exactly what's going on. We've got here three examples of people killing dragons. The only one you could probably tell without reading the text is this one, because it's associated with Isfandiar, who's a bit of a coward compared with the others, and he sort of turns up in an early version of a tank and kills the dragon. But essentially, there's a lot of dragon killing going on. And I would say that until probably 10 or 15 years ago, most books that were concerned with Persian miniature painting, they were really just looking at the paintings. They weren't regarding these as paintings in a text. So you have a nice picture of someone killing a dragon. It's perhaps not terribly important who it is. But of course, it is important who it is. It's important because you want to know what the subject of the painting is. You want to know how the artist has responded to the text to see if he's illustrating actually what the text says. And also it's important for a different reason, two different reasons. One is someone has commissioned this manuscript. The paintings aren't just there in a random way. So someone has said, I want a picture of so-and-so killing a dragon. It's not just anybody killing a dragon. I want a picture of so-and-so killing a dragon. So there's a choice. And secondly, therefore, you need to be comparing one thing with another. You need to be comparing the picture of Bahram Gur killing a dragon in one manuscript with Bahram Gur killing a dragon in another manuscript to see how they relate to the text, how they relate to each other, if one artist has drawn on the previous depiction of this scene in the work of an earlier artist. So it is important to identify the scenes and therefore the text, in other words, in these articles, these artifacts, which really illustrated manuscripts tend to be looked at for their paintings. But in fact, I think it's extremely important to reunite them more specifically with their text. So we spend a lot of time, again, analyzing where they come, and therefore clearing up what you might call generic battle scenes, generic scenes of people killing dragons, and associating them with specific events for the purposes I've mentioned. Now, Bahram Gur was a great hunter. Here we see two pictures from rather different types of manuscripts of Bahram Gur killing two lions, both in manuscripts in Manchester. And you see that they come at completely different places in the text. This one comes, this is verse 916 of the edition by Mole, and this is 265. So they're completely different episodes. But without the text, we wouldn't know which particular episode it was. And without building up a database of these things, we wouldn't be able to compare the picture of the first episode with the picture of the second episode. And also, we may not understand the significance of why these images have been chosen in this particular copy. Here we have two more examples. Again, wildly different parts in the text. So at least four different stories of Bahram Gur killing dragons in the Shahnameh. Then there's a case of extraneous material. Sometimes the paintings may contain images or part of the imagery that has nothing to do with the text. Here we have Alexander, who's supposed to be seeking the source of life, which he doesn't, but he is supposed to be accompanied by Khizr, who's like the green man in English myth. But here he's clearly got a friend with him, who's probably the prophet Ilyas. So this is something that's not in the text at all. There's another nice example of this, which is something Firouza has worked on. There's a famous story, rather like Nebuchadnezzar, of the king, Kekavus, being tempted to go up into the heavens and conquer heaven, conquer the skies, because he's already master of the earth, and he's tempted to go up and conquer the heavens. And here on the left, these both come in almost identical places in the text, we see Kekavus being lifted up on this sort of winged contraption with hungry eagles who have been starved of food, and there's some nice juicy steaks up there, and they're flying up into the sky, and eventually, of course, they run out of energy and they crash down to earth again. But in the one on the right, we see Kekavus shooting an arrow at an angel, which isn't in the text at all. And furthermore, in other versions, we see, again, very similar place, well, identical place there. I'm afraid you can't really see this terribly well, but there's an angel there holding out a fish, and Kekavus is shooting the fish with an arrow, and this story, in fact, comes from a totally different narrative and is about God saying, well, we'd better let this idiot pretend that he's killed me, so here's a fish for him to kill, and he'll see the blood, and he'll think he's conquered heavens, and then he'll go back down again. This is nothing to do with the Shahnameh. This is a different story altogether. But the artists have so taken over that their repertoire shows the ascent. In other words, they're painting pictures for more than one manuscript, of course, more than one story by this time, and so they are using their skills and the iconography that they have developed in their studios to illustrate texts which may have nothing to do with it. So that's an incredibly brief roundup of the project, and that's the website. Essentially, for every museum, we have a little bit of contact details. Ideally, we have some description of the museum itself, we have some description of the collection. At a glance, you see the manuscripts held in the Brooklyn Museum. They're all single sheets, and these are the sample page. So for every location, we have a description. For every manuscript, sometimes a manuscript is a single page. This is simply a library item, We have a description of it, where it is, the date, the calligrapher, if we know it, if it's a single sheet or a book and all this stuff, how far we've got. And then we show this, as I say, this is just a single page. And then you see the painting itself. This is one I showed you before. You can look at it more closely, which means that you can study the text and you can, if you get good quality pictures like you do from some museums, it's obviously extremely readable. And you have all the so-called metadata that goes with this particular image. So we know when it was produced as much as possible. So here we can see very briefly different versions dated from the earliest right through to the latest. And if you could see it more closely and you had more time, you'd obviously be able to see, I say, at least two things. One is that there's an extraordinary development, and secondly, that no two pictures are the same. And I can tell you we've got something like 20,000 pictures recorded. No two pictures are the same. And if that isn't the most extraordinary comment on the inventiveness and the skill and the imagination of the artists who were illustrating a single text over 300 or 400 years, I think this is in itself the most astonishing figure. If you are more interested in a particular part of the story, you can go and look at the story. And so it's bringing together materials from literally all over the world and allowing them to be compared one with another. And a whole load of questions that I think really could hardly have been asked before. Which are the most popular scenes? Which are most popular scenes at a certain period? Which are the most popular scenes in a certain court? I mean, there aren't necessarily answers to all this at the moment, because although we've been going over 10 years, I mean, you know, every time you think about it, you think of a new question to ask, or you think of a new way of answering an old question. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. Thank you.